So can you join me in giving a very loud applause for Professor DeHart? Thank you. Luckily, I think I got to talk with most of you, not everybody, beforehand, so you already knew some of that stuff about me. I'm so tickled to be here, not only because it's not raining, but because it's really nice to be able to engage with the Puget Sound community outside of the classroom. Ironically, you know, now you want to hear lectures, right? I mean, when you're in school, people are like, oh, gotta go. Now you get to do it in your spare time, and hopefully it's enjoyable for you as well. The talk I'm going to give tonight kind of gives a sense of, in a more concrete way, all the different hats that I wear that Allison was talking about. And to give you a little bit of background on that, as she mentioned, I'm a cultural anthropologist at the Comparative Sociology Department. I know the name doesn't fit. But I teach courses on development, and I teach courses on migration. I'm also the director of Latin American Studies, so I teach courses on Latin American social movements, and my migration course deals a lot with that. And I just returned recently from leading our Oaxaca, Mexico Study Abroad program, which is a fall semester program, and it's all students from UPS and our neighbor PLU, and we spend a semester studying all sorts of courses in Spanish down in Mexico. So this talk brings together work that I do in the classroom, work that I do on the campus. It brings together work that I do in my own research. I brought a copy of my book, in case anybody wanted to see that she mentioned, because it's unpronounceable, I guess, in terms of. And it, you know, brings together my recent work with students in Mexico as part of the study abroad program. During that time that we were abroad, part of the program is that I teach a course, an anthropology course, which was it was a great time for me. It's the first time I get to teach a course in Spanish, because it's part of our Mexico course. So the course that I taught down there was an anthropology course focusing on Mexico's southern border instead of the northern border. The northern border gets all the news, and the southern border kind of is in the shadows. So we did an anthropology course looking at Mexico's southern border and trying to rethink Mexico and much of the region from that kind of southern perspective. So the talk that I'm going to give kind of draws on both work that I was doing in Mexico and previous work that I've done, and is more suggestive than anything else to try to bring together some ideas that hopefully you know something about and maybe haven't thought about in these ways, but in a good UPS tradition also generate some good questions, hopefully some provocative discussion that you might be interested in having, and I'm definitely open for questions afterward. So the title of the talk is Border Battles in the other north being Mexico, as it's referred to in everywhere south of Mexico, this being the real El Norte, but Mexico as well referred to in that sense. And what I'd like to do is try to bring together discussion about the migrants passing through Mexico, not the ones we usually hear about coming to the United States from Mexico, organized crime in Mexico, and development in that area. And to start out, I want to bring you to a couple moments that kind of framed our experience in Mexico just recently. On August 2010, you may remember from the headlines, 72 migrants were found murdered in Tamaulipas, Mexico. These were 72 Central American, mostly, migrants, one Ecuadorian, and I think one person from India, but mostly Honduran, mostly Salvadoran and Guatemalan migrants were found murdered in this ranch in Tamaulipas, and caused a big stir in Mexico, obviously because of just the number of people, but also because it began to bring light to something that had been happening for quite some time, but had not been receiving much press. As we left Oaxaca in December, once again there was a mass abduction in Oaxaca of 40 migrants, again Central American migrants that had just come into Mexico and were abducted, and this was remarkable. Luckily they weren't massacred, but it was remarkable because there was a big debate in the press about whether, in fact, these migrants had been abducted. There had been reports by one migrant who had escaped the abduction. He'd gone to a shelter and reported the kidnapping, and officials from the Mexican state had said, no, there actually hasn't been any kidnapping. There was really nothing. So this phenomenon was interesting because we see on the one hand a couple things happening. 300,000 undocumented migrants passing through Mexico on the way to the north to the United States. These are people coming mostly from Central America, further south as well. But they're not the kind of people that we are often talking about or thinking about in the news when we talk about the immigration debate. But they're certainly a big issue for Mexico at this moment. They're traveling at least 1,500 miles, crossing the southern Mexican border across the Suchiate River from Guatemala mostly. This seems to be the biggest entry point into Chiapas. And they moved this 1,500 miles to the U.S. hidden in plain sight. They are traveling well-known routes all the way up to the United States, even though they are traveling illegally in Mexico. This train picture shows you a little bit of it. And if you've seen movies like Sin Nombre, which just came out a couple years ago, and some others now, there's been more and more press that's trying to sort of shed light on this, on these routes. You can see from this map, these are railway lines moving north, and you can almost use them as routes also for these migrants. I'm going to highlight over here. Migrants are moving through the southern corridor here and tend to move up these two northern routes on the east side. They tend to be the biggest routes for Central American migrants moving north. And as I'll show you later, this also makes them important in terms of other kinds of maps of Mexico as well. So I want to think a little bit about what these migrants and these headlines about them tell us. What do they show us about what's happening in terms of the development in the region? We're used to thinking about here the recession, the fact that people are out of work. There has certainly been a sense of migration declining in some ways in the last year or two as a result of that. So why is there this huge flow of people north at this moment when it seems like opportunities here in the United States should be diminished? What is it about looking at development in the region that will help us understand that? The other question that this raises, of course, is what does it tell us about organized crime in Mexico? We read daily in the papers about killings in northern Mexico, drug cartels in Mexico, and they are essentially involved in this these abductions of migrants. So how can looking at these migrants help us to understand a little bit about what they're about and what they're up to? And lastly, what's really interesting here is thinking about what these migrants tell us about the sort of immigration debates and policies that are happening in Mexico, alongside our current debate about immigration reform and our current effort to reform policy. There's some really interesting parallels between the two cases and some unique dilemmas that Mexico faces that I want to ask about as we go. So to give you a little bit of background on what we're talking about, of those 300,000 migrants that are heading north, last year, the Mexican National Commission on Human Rights reported 20,000 abductions in Mexico of Central American migrants. These numbers are based on reports by other migrants. They're based on reports by people working in the migrant shelters that are found throughout Mexico, and they are likely to be underreported. So this is probably a low number, relatively speaking. Of those people that have been kidnapped, the vast majority are Central Americans, so 44.3% Hondurans, Salvadorans and Guatemalans, single percentages of Ecuadorans, Brazilians, Colombians, and others. But the biggest pool is coming from Central America. These are coming not just as sort of individual kidnappings. These are really mass abductions, so large groups or handfuls at a time are being abducted. The headline that I showed you about 40 people being abducted in Oaxaca is very common. So a whole group will be taken at a single time, and people in that group meeting different fates depending on a variety of factors that I'll address. And the majority of these abductions are happening in a couple states, and if we look back at this map, it's right up the northeast side, Tamaulipas, Veracruz, and Tabasco. So they're right along that same corridor that we saw the trains moving north. It's not just randomly throughout the country. It's really in a concentrated space that these migrant abductions are happening. So when we think about why this is happening and thinking about the development part of it, you know, like I said, one of the questions is why are there so many people moving north through Mexico at this time when theoretically the United States, their destination, is, you know, in the throes of massive unemployment, you know, big economic recession. There's a lot of things that help to explain why the pull and also the push from Central America is still so strong. One of them is the incredible number of natural disasters over the last year or two in Central America. If we take Guatemala as an example, just last year, it was hit by two massive tropical storm hurricanes, Agatha being one of them, which right off the bat caused 30,000 people to be displaced, hundreds of deaths, several massive disasters, and I don't know if some of you saw the big sinkhole. Did anybody see footage of that humongous sinkhole? Really, really massive infrastructural damage, both in the capital and in the foothills and the highlands, compounded by the eruption of a volcano right outside the capital city. It's one of those things where just injury to insult, with massive dislocations of a population that's already living in major poverty and unemployment and so forth. So natural disasters has made people's lives very difficult in Guatemala especially. The Central American Free Trade Agreement, the partner of NAFTA, that is, as of 2006, includes Central America, has not, unfortunately, provided for most people the kind of economic benefits that were touted and hoped for. Especially small farmers have been incredibly hard hit by the opening of markets and the flood of very inexpensive corn from the United States, which has put a lot of corn farmers in Central America out of work. Maquiladoras, the assembly plants that had really been promoted as going to be one of the big engines driving development in the region, has had the wind sucked out of it. A lot of those assembly plants have moved to China and other places, and so that what people have is an influx of cheaper goods both from China and the U.S. and not the promised jobs and development that were supposed to come with it. So a lot of compounding of economic problems for people in Central America. Major political instability still is a problem in several countries. You may recall 2009 and 2010 in Honduras, the coup that put the President Zelaya out of power, and we had a major standoff for a while the Obama administration tried to figure out whether to recognize the new administration or how to deal with those. The regimes in other countries of Central America have been a little more secure in terms of the leadership, but not in terms of real authority or mandate. So there's a real sense of instability and insecurity in terms of the political systems in those countries right now, making, again, people's sense of their ability to invest in the future there, their ability to plan and build their lives there, very, very difficult. This is compounded by a real rise in, it's almost, I feel bad calling it physical insecurity. I mean it in the most visceral terms, crime, violent crime. You have in both El Salvador and Guatemala huge amounts of gang activity right now. In many ways, we've exported it by virtue of people that we've deported from the United States, and we've really, in many ways, helped the circulation of what's now a very transnational, the Mara Salvatrucha, for example, the MR-16, and also various others that work now through Guatemala and El Salvador, and have paired in really, really complex ways with in both of these countries where there were civil wars, people that were in the military and now don't have the same jobs are working kind of as private security or mercenaries, working with these gangs and working with the drug cartels that I'll talk about. You have this really diffused kind of network of people involved in kind of delinquent behavior, violence, trafficking of different sorts, which means that the daily sense of security in the street is just incredibly difficult. In Guatemala, for example, gangs have targeted the buses, extorting bus drivers for their fares, and bus drivers finally had enough and started to arm themselves and fight back. And now there's these incredibly violent encounters between bus drivers, municipal bus drivers, and gangs trying to extort them. And then bus drivers against bus drivers because they're not paying off the gangs, they're fighting off against them. So incredible amounts of insecurity, violence, and delinquency in everyday life, which make people fear for their lives, again, not feel like businesses that they might start are tenable, not feel like it's safe for their children, really begin to feel like the United States or some other future, even if it's in the midst of economic recession, would be far preferable. This is, of course, enhanced by a little pull factor from the U.S., which is remittances, that money that folks that are here send down to their families and kin. And that is no small change. In places like Guatemala and Salvador, that's 10% of the gross national product. That's more than foreign aid coming in from foreign development organizations. It's oftentimes the second highest generator of foreign exchange and so forth. So these are big amounts of money that are coming in, really big incentives for people that feel their lives crumbling from out beneath them in these countries. So we have people desperate to move north, desperate for opportunities, and we have in Mexico, and actually not just in Mexico, throughout the region, the rise of a new phenomenon in the last many years. You've noticed they're talked about in lots of different terms. We talk about drug cartels. But really, there's a lot of people now that talk about them more as organized crime because of the big, you know, panorama of economic different ventures that they're involved in. It's not really just drug trafficking. And the kinds of networks they have are so much more similar to what we think about in terms of the mafia here, or organized crime that is well established across many sectors. That's a more appropriate term. Other security analysts now would call them terrorist organizations because they, you know, work in violence, essentially. And their efforts are to create instability, to create fear, to create massive disruptions in order to keep both their hold on territory and also to keep people in fear. So organized crime or terrorist organizations is probably a much more useful way of talking about these groups. There's about seven of them. They change in number because they subdivide. It's like, you know, little cells subdividing and so forth from day to day. But they're battling for control over territory, moving marijuana, methamphetamines, and cocaine to the United States. And they work closely, unfortunately, with officials in Mexico. Local police, federal police, bureaucrats, elected officials, all of them have been linked in different ways to these drug cartels. So their work wouldn't be possible just on the basis of their brute violence or just on the basis of their manpower. It really is well integrated into different levels of Mexican security, military, and even elected officials. And they've been well trained. Many of these drug cartels come from groups that have been trained by U.S. Special Forces or are drawing on ex-Special Force agents from Central American wars. So, for example, Guatemala has a special force group that participated in its civil war called the Caibiles. They were kind of like we'd think about, you know, the sort of Green Beret special forces. After that civil conflict ended in 1996, those guys found new work up in Mexico, where they were recruited to teach a lot of these folks in the drug cartels about the kind of violence and mayhem that they used as part of the civil war in Guatemala. So many attribute to them, for example, some of the most violent crimes, the beheadings and the real dehumanizing kinds of violence. So these guys aren't just Mexican organizations. They're very transnational organizations drawing on very specialized training. This is an eyeful. But this map tries to give you a sense of the kind of movements through Mexico of different drugs. The colors, you can see, stand for the different substances. We're talking about cocaine, ephedra, marijuana, and meth. You can see them coming from Asia, down south from Colombia, Venezuela, and Brazil, into Mexico. And then they're concentrated in little hubs. You can see
Acapulco, which has been a real bad source of violence, is a kind of an entry point and a movement point. Again, you can see on the East Coast, Veracruz, Tampico, up along the way, also a big trafficking point moving stuff north. So
we hear about it in Mexico, but it's part of an international movement of narcotics coming up from Latin America and from Asia. Since 2006, Mexican President Felipe Calderón has declared a war on drugs, and that has meant the militarization, basically, of Mexico. He's deployed the military to fight this battle. There have been 34,000 drug-related deaths since that time. Shouldn't be any surprise in some ways, given the headlines, but when you think about this comparatively, since 2003 in Iraq, we have 31,931 deaths. So the Mexican drug war in the last, right, since 2006 has already beat that. Campaign Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, we have 10,453 troops casualties. So this is massive in terms of the number of casualties, if we think about them in those terms, in this war on drugs in Mexico. The United States has been involved. Plan Merida, which went into effect in 2006, or was signed on to in 2006, was an attempt by the U.S. to help Mexico secure its borders, specifically its southern border. This means the U.S. has promised both equipment, surveillance equipment, arms, and other sorts of high-tech stuff to be deployed at Mexico's southern border, mostly. It's also promised consultation and training and stuff like that for the forces. So the U.S. Committed $1.6 billion for that first three-year initiative. And maybe you heard just in the fall, Hillary Clinton mentioned there's conditions placed on these funds. Mexico has to comply with certain kinds of human rights advances or standards, and it didn't in its last round. So some of the money has been withheld based on that contingency, but other kinds of funds continue to go through. So the United States is also trying to help buttress these borders in these ways. I'm going to focus on one particular group because it's the one that most relates to migrants. Las Zetas is one of, like I said, several of these organized crime groups. It's the one that's most implicated in terms of trafficking and abduction of migrants. And I'll talk a little bit more about what that means. But I wanted to show you this sign because it shows you a little bit about what the Zetas are and where they come from, and I'll translate. These are common, though, because the Zetas and other drug cartels often put out banners all over the cities that they're working in to sort of leave messages for the public. This one says that the Zetas love you, militaries or ex-military folks. We offer you a good salary, food, and attention to your family. You won't suffer any abuse. You won't suffer hunger. We won't give you the... Cup of soup. Thank you. We won't give you a cup of soup, which is... got a bad fame in Mexico. These, you know, the instant soups have become the really cheap food available for people. So it's kind of a dig saying, you know, you won't have to eat a cup of soup with us. You know, you can relax and call us at this number, give you a phone number to call. They're appealing to people, like I said, based on the development stuff, that are in dire circumstances, that are not receiving the kind of income they need to sustain their families, that are, you know, really suffering, and they're offering them some work, right? This particular group, though, the Zetas, is fascinating because it comes out of a group, an acronym, G-A-F-E, GAFE, or the they were a special forces team put together by the Mexican government to fight drugs. They were trained by U.S. forces to help do the drug war. At a certain point, however, their leader, or one of the guys in the group, and 30 of his followers, decided to leave the military, the Mexican military, and began to work kind of as hired mercenaries for one of the cartel groups, the Gulf Cartel, and were kind of their henchmen for a good while until that particular cartel was crippled by the Mexican government, and the leader of this group thought he would just take up his own group. And since then has become independent and really formed one of the nastiest, most violent drug cartels of them all. But again, interesting, its evolution coming out of the anti-drug effort and then working in the support mode for the drug cartels and then becoming its own beast up to itself. This one in particular uses a lot of those Guatemalan caibiles, the special forces, and thus is, you know, again, very much associated with the kind of really dehumanizing violence, dismembering and beheading its victims and making these sort of big public statements, not just killing them. But they're making $12 to $15 billion a year on their business. So they're not, again, not small change in terms of what's at stake for them. This is where you can see why they're important. This area of red along the east coast is the area that the Zetas control. And if you look back to the right at that northern freight train route again, you can see that they control that area exactly where these Central American migrants are moving north. So they have a real hold over that territory, both because of the drug flows in that area, but also because, again, they're building basically on a business with these migrants as well. So the question is, why migrants matter? Why do they care? They're making $12 billion on moving drugs through the country. What the heck do they want poor people that are moving north to make money, right? I mean, why, and before they've even gotten there. So there's this real strange, apparently, sense of why migrants matter. But when we look a little bit more closely, one of the things that's very clear is the economic potential of these migrants, even before they get to the United States. The economic potential of these migrants is something that is really only recently been recognized by lots of people. One of the things that I talk about a lot in my book is the fact that the people like the United Nations, the World Bank, and so forth, and states really overlooked the role of migrants for a long time in terms of what they could do for development for their countries. And so in 2007, the United Nations put out this report where one of its economists said, you know, migrants are making more than foreign aid in many of these countries. We need to mainstream migration as a development strategy. We need to harness the power of these migrants in order to really make development happen in these places. Instead of flooding countries with aid or trying to do these empowerment projects, we've got to use migrants. Well, the drug cartels are also thinking in similar ways, right? They realize one thing, which is that most of these migrants that are heading north are doing what we call chain migration. They're not heading out lone wolf on their own to the frontier. They've got family, they've got footholds, they're following in somebody else's footsteps, they're joining up with somebody else, right? This means that when they're abducted en route, they're usually carrying phone numbers or they know somebody's phone number. And so what happens when they're abducted is that they are interrogated for that phone number, and then the gang members, the cartel members, call these family members in the U.S. and extort money out of the family members for the release of their loved one in Mexico. And they require that that money be Western Unioned down to Mexico in order to ensure the release of their loved one. Okay. So knowing that people are going to meet up with family, one of the abduction, you know, strategies is to milk these migrants who are not, they might have money on them and that's stolen, but to use them as a kind of a strategy of getting money from their family members in the U.S. Like I said before, you know, the remittance potential is so big. You know, these migrants in the north are, you know, sending down 10% of the GDP for these countries. So that means that these organized crime groups that are abducting them are getting big money out of people. They're saying these people are sending big portions of their income down. They have reserves, $5,000 for the release of your loved one, $10,000 for the release of your loved one. These aren't, again, small amounts that are being requested, but big flows. And they're not just young men that are moving, but women and children as well. So there's a huge, huge number of women that are being abducted, horrific kinds of assaults on all of them, but a very, very high number of sexual assaults on women and children, and many of them also abducted not just, again, to extort money from family members in the North, but to be placed into other kinds of human trafficking, sex slavery, labor, and oftentimes drug smuggling themselves. They extort them, like I said, for money. The other thing that they do that's really interesting is they use these migrants because they have no recourse, again, as kind of workers, right, a little gopher. So they have them smuggling drugs for them, but they also have them, some of them working in different ways. One is kind of as henchmen doing violence. Another is infiltrating shelters. So there's these kind of safe houses, like I said, all the way through Mexico for migrants. And oftentimes the drug cartels will have people planted there to find out from migrants where they're going, who they're meeting up with, where they're going to be, and then they report that information back to the drug cartels, and as soon as that person leaves the shelter, they're abducted, and they've got all the information on them in order to kind of cherry pick those that might be the most lucrative. So people that are, you know, abducted in this way have, again, very little choice in the matter. You know, they're the people that you saw, the migrants that you saw in that very first slide that were killed, the report was that they had been told, you either work for us or you die, and they said no, and they were killed. So what's at stake for these migrants in either accepting or not accepting is their own lives. There's not a lot of leeway. In terms of the issues that this raises for Mexico, there's some interesting immigration policy issues for them. Obviously, one problem that these migrant abductions raises is it really shows that kind of entanglement of public officials, federal and local law enforcement in the process. There is no way that the drug cartels could do this on their own. It is with, in many ways, the help or at least the courteous blind eye of law enforcement. Oftentimes, migrants will report that they were robbed first by federal police and then they were abducted by the drug cartels, so that there's a sense of them working in tandem. On top of this problem of corruption, there's also a very long history of a need for immigration reform in Mexico. Mexico has had a policy, its Article 33 of its constitution, allows for pretty much arbitrary arrest and deportation of any foreigner on its soil. And it also has very, very strict immigration policies, incarceration and deportation for people that are undocumented. So it's much more stringent than the United States, in fact, and many would say used very arbitrarily and in ways that have been highly problematic. But given now these migrants that are being abducted and facing all of these problems within its border, Mexico has been under a lot of pressure from human rights organizations and the global community to have a way of dealing with this issue. Migrants have had no recourse. They can't go file a complaint. I was kidnapped, or I was robbed, or I was sexually assaulted coming through your country. There's absolutely no, there hasn't been any mechanism for them to report, and there hasn't been any kind of recourse for them. So just last month, in fact, Mexico passed a new immigration law in the Senate. This bill is important because it authorizes someone to stay and work in Mexico while a case is investigated. So if a Salvadoran coming through is assaulted or in some ways, you know, violated and makes a claim, they're allowed to stay in the country while that process is investigated. It gives them the possibility of access to health and legal services, as well as a chance of normalizing their status as a result of that investigation. And it increases the penalties for human trafficking, really tries to increase the disincentives for that. In addition, there's been a unified strategy for preventing and combating the kidnapping of migrants. That's a direct translation. That is another strategy that is has been proposed by the Mexican Commission for Human Rights, which tries to go beyond just the legal part and really tries to think about ways in which Mexican authorities can try to dismantle the gangs and target some of the enabling forces. For example, they've targeted Western Union. They say none of this would be possible if Western Union wasn't helping by facilitating these flows. And if we walk into a Western Union office and look at the register, we can see exactly this list of abductions. We can see the family members from the United States. We can see the drug cartel member who picked up the funds. There's a record. This institution is, you know, a financial institution, as a really important piece in this puzzle, and that if we begin to look at some of those enabling forces as well as the drug cartels, we can really begin to make a difference. There's some predicaments that come along with this. One is that there's some interesting echoes here with Arizona's Senate Bill 1070, in the sense that Mexico has been a very staunch opponent of that Senate bill and indeed has been a strong advocate for its citizens' rights in the United States, even as undocumented migrants. But many have said that this new law that was passed last month does many of the same things. Even though it tries to increase these benefits for migrants, it also grants more powers to police and increases fines for businesses. It authorizes sweeps and detention of undocumented migrants. So some worry that it has some of them called it racist profiling kinds of dimensions, just like the Arizona bill has. So here's Calderon slamming the Arizona law and issuing a travel advisory against the United States. Many have accused now that this new law in Mexico is doing the same. To kind of wrap up, I just want to stress a couple things about this, which is that we can see here that Mexico faces a kind of similar dilemma, right? On the one hand, it needs to figure out a way to protect these vulnerable migrants that are passing through its country. It is enough of a human rights issue, right? 20,000 abductions last year, right? 72 deaths in that massacre. I mean, we see massive, massive numbers here. But it's also got to enforce its sovereignty. It's also got to, work against all those colorful arrows that I showed you, the drug flows coming in and, worries about terrorism and security. It has an added incentive to do this, thinking about the migrants, because it also wants to theoretically combat organized crime, right? This has really been one of the defining issues in Mexican policy for the last 2 years. It has unique challenges, though, as it tries to do this, in the sense that the problem isn't just within Mexico, right? The demand for these drugs that are coming north are in the United States. The employment that these migrants are seeking is in the United States. The corruption that is allowing these migrants to be targeted in this way implicates the Mexican state. So there's a real need for different kinds of reforms that are not going to be easy ones to deal with. We have a strong stake in this in terms of the United States. This map shows you again on the bottom some of the same areas of drug cartel influence and also member stations, so to speak, up in the United States. To imagine that these cartels are only working in Mexico is a dream. They are well positioned in the United States. They are well positioned throughout Guatemala, Salvador, Honduras. In fact, the president of Guatemala in January initiated a state of siege in one of the central states that's kind of a transit corridor into Mexico. He said, we can't handle all the drugs and, cartels moving through our territory. We have to do a sort of state of emergency in order to clamp down and really restrict things. The Zetas responded by saying, we're going to start killing civilians if you don't lift this state of siege. We run things here. You don't run things here. And essentially in Guatemala, that's true now. So both in the United States and in Central America beyond, we have a really strong stake in seeing these organized crimes and these migrant issues resolved. And here's where our good discussion can come from. One of the things that this, like I said, poses is this need for new immigration policy in both countries, right? Clearly, the United States is debating what it should do, how to do secure its borders, but at the same time protect people, at the same time support its economy that has relied so centrally on migrants, and Mexico similarly. There's a need for coordinated regional perspective on these transnational flows. So Mexico doing something about drugs or Mexico doing something about immigrants isn't going to be enough. Clearly, there's a way in which, because this is a transnational, set of flows, the people that are moving, the drugs that are moving, all of these things that are moving, there's a need for a much more coordinated kind of effort in terms of these reforms, instead of just nation by nation, right? And there's need for, different kinds of development issues to emerge, right? Other kinds of economic opportunities in these countries that take away this need to move north the United States, right? That take away this need for, like we saw, the cup of soup families in Mexico to join up with the drug cartels, right? So I want to propose here, just with these bullets, that there's this need for a whole set of reforms and debates about these issues that will go far beyond one national border and one national policy and begin to think critically about, as we have with production and circulation like NAFTA, how flows of other kinds across our nations might be dealt with fruitfully from a regional perspective. I'll close here and open it up to questions that you might have or comments that you might have. Living in the other border yourself here, hopefully that's something that's been prescient for you as well. So, questions? Yeah, Sandra.
What's your opinion on...
I don't.
Okay.
No. I think here the thing is this. You know, I guess when you think back to the beginning of this presentation, 300,000 migrants moving across Mexico to the United States. These are people that are not, I mean, they're not Mexicans. These are people from south of Mexico moving north, plus Mexicans that are moving north. To imagine that we can just build a physical barrier and that will stop people, one, I think is ludicrous. But two, I also think that when we begin to think about this issue with migrants in Mexico, we see again the problems with that, because people become increasingly vulnerable to different sorts of forces based on this need to move north in really, precarious ways, right? We're going to ride the trains up north. We're going to do this to go up north. We're going to do all across the desert and these things, right? Each of these security solutions that we have that's about a physical wall seems to create more vulnerability for migrants rather than stopping the problem. So I think that's why I would promote, again, some kind of reform, but that's not just about our border. The U.S. National Intelligence Director, James Clapper, just said yesterday, the day before, that Mexico's drug war poses a security threat to the United States. It clearly does, right? So simply, you know, putting up the wall, he says we can't control who's going in through our borders. Our immigration service, right, process is flawed. We've got all sorts of things that we can do to buttress that and secure our borders in more effective ways, I think, than the wall. Yes. Yeah.
Does Mexico feel the same way or exploit their people for cheap labor purposes?
That's what's so interesting, because, again, most of these migrants are not heading into Mexico to stay in Mexico. They're crossing Mexico to head to the United States. So on the one hand, they have a very discriminatory attitude toward migrants, right? They don't, they see them as being lesser than second cousins, backward bumpkins from Central America, and they see them potentially as a threat in terms of those who stay on and work in lower wage professions in Mexico. But they're more of a problem in that they're transiting through Mexico and serving as this source of, on the one hand, wealth for people that are able to benefit from the corruption, right? But more of a problem than an economic resource or problem from that, like it is for us, exactly.
Well, they're being entrusted to migration to benefit to the post.
Mm-hmm. Mostly illicit, because if it's not the abductions, I guess there's certain sectors that benefit in terms of either trafficking or smuggling, right? So smuggling is, with their agreement, they're paying coyotes or paying people to cross the border, right? So there's certain people that make money off of that. Many would argue all organized crime. They're not like, you know, free agents out there anymore. But the other is trafficking, which is people against their will, right? Taking people across the border, either to smuggle the drugs, extorting them that way. So, I wouldn't say the larger population is benefiting from it in any way or exploiting them in any way, but, yeah.
Generalized terms. Do the migrants who are coming up through Mexico know these risks when they make this decision and they still do it anyways?
Yes.
Let alone the risk of getting across the United States border. But
yes.
They understand all these risks.
Yes.
And they still do it. Is it still worth it to them and their families?
There's several really incredible documentaries out there that I'm happy to recommend that are just excruciating in that sense. People know exactly what's coming. They know exactly what's coming. Women take certain birth control before they leave, assuming oftentimes that they will be raped in the process, knowing that this is part of the cost of going north. But trusting wholeheartedly in this idea that they will make it, one, to the United States, and that once they're here, that their lives will be better because they'll be able to provide for their families in new ways. They'll be able to work. They'll be able to create the lives that they wanted to. So that's one of the hugest tragedies. It's not that people are ignorant at all. In fact, there's a lot of information put out by the Mexican government, put out by the Central American governments, put out by different aid organizations to dissuade people. When we were in Oaxaca, like I said, there's these migrant shelters around, and there's a shelter in Oaxaca, and they try to dissuade migrants. They say, go home. Don't go any further. Turn around. You know, there's nothing good ahead of you. Here's what awaits you. And in a second case scenario where the migrant says, I'm still going, they said, okay, well then take these precautions. If anybody says, you know, I'm going to give you a job, no problem, or, you know, but don't, you know, they try to at least give them some tools for distinguishing between reputable and irreputable kinds of people that they might encounter. But they wholeheartedly try to turn them around and send them home.
What percentage of the migrants face that are abducted or assaulted or whatever? Mm-hmm. Greater than 50%?
I wouldn't. Well, there's some statistics that say 1 in 6. 1 in 6 migrants face some kind of assault or abduction or rape or some kind of issue along the way. The official numbers that I gave you here, which are from, again, the Mexican Human Rights Commission, 300,000, they say, are passing through. 20,000 were abducted. So, again, if we take those numbers, that's a smaller percentage. Then. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's mostly run by a lot of times church, faith-based organizations, working with other organizations oftentimes. All they are a place, knowing the kinds of gauntlet that migrants go through, it's a place, usually they have a maximum of 3 days that they can stay there. So it's not a long-term facility. It's a kind of an emergency stopgap. People that have been robbed, assaulted, injured in the process can go there and get a reference to a resource, can get clothes, so they can get a new pair of shoes most people lose everything in the path. And again, information about, again, going home or if they're going to go forward to try to give them tools to go forward safely. But these shelters by no means want to support migrants' journey, so to speak, in the sense of encouraging them north. It's a human rights, they think of it just as a human, you know, dignity issue. Nobody, you know, there should be some recourse for these people that are clearly there, clearly suffering, and have nowhere to turn. So, and the number of migrants that they can handle are very small, because they're just small little, you know, they have like 30 beds, you know. So you figure 3 nights, given 300,000 people moving north, the vast majority don't make use of those. Yeah.
I mean, I suppose it's
Mm-hmm. Several weeks, can be like 3 weeks. Again, the train routes, if people are, depending on how often they get on or off the trains, again, the one slide I showed you, and if you've seen the movie like Sin Nombre, I mean, these are packs of people riding on these trains. They stop the trains often. They have everybody get down. Oftentimes they rob them at that point, abduct some people at that point. So it takes people a while to get money again, to get going again, or find some way to turn around even. You know, I mean, it's fits and starts. So, but it can be 3 weeks just to get up to the border. And for many of them, Central Americans can actually move through Central America without, it's just a friendly neighbor policy with just visas. But once they hit Mexico, that for them is like Mexicans hitting the United States. That's where there's no, right, they're not welcome. There's major enforcement at that border. And that's where many report the assaults beginning, the violence beginning for them. Crossing that border is usually a real gauntlet for people. Yeah.
I have 2 questions. Interested in this. Second question is, if we ease our laws, which we're mm-hmm. always discussing, legalizing marijuana, mm-hmm. do you see that would have any effect?
Yeah. I got involved in several ways. One is that I worked for many years in Guatemala in basically rural communities, looking at development organizations. And there was no way you could do that work without seeing and taking note of all the people that were missing. Huge numbers of those folks were missing. In certain communities where I worked, 25% of the men were gone. And so migration was kind of a natural part of understanding what was happening in Central America in terms of development. I also began work in the United States with a UN initiative that was called, sexy title, the Digital Diaspora for Latin America, which tried to recruit Latinos and say, don't you want to help your brethren back home? And it specifically targeted Latinos in the tech industry and wanted them to not just send money, but to actually go train people in these tech skills that would allow them to kind of develop. And the program failed miserably because, first of all, they were trying to, like, you're Latino. You're Latino. You know, you're people back in Latin America. And, you know, so it was highly problematic. And I got interested in migrants on this end in those terms. And then, you know, living in Oaxaca for the last semester with my students, we worked, several of the students had internships with the migrant shelter. They had an opportunity to talk to these migrants on a daily basis. And one of the really compelling things about that experience is you hear migrants talk, and I know in some ways now it's common, like this, you hear somebody's story, you know, hear somebody's story. And that can be really powerful, but I'm always struck. I'll tell you one woman, Rosa, that was moving through. She was Honduran, and she had come to the United States when she was 15 and worked in L.A. as a maid in a house. And through that, employer had gotten papers and became legal, got a green card. She married. She had kids. She and her husband moved to Florida. She was working in the construction business. She was really good at what she did. She told me, I'm a specialist in granite. Started her own masonry business, was highly successful entrepreneur, you know, had, you know, stuff of her own, a successful business, divorced her husband, was just a really powerful woman, legal in the United States, everything. And her mom got sick in Honduras. And her siblings weren't around. She went down to take care of her mom. Her mom's condition really digressed quickly. She was in the hospital, and Rosa overstayed her time away. Given her green card, she was only allotted a certain, like, you know, 10 days out of the country. She overstayed the time. She went to the U.S., you know, embassy there in Honduras and said, I'm really sorry. Here's what happened. Here's the hospital. I need to petition to... They said, sorry. Sorry. They actually told her, you want to get back so bad, go across the border. She says, my kids are in the U.S. They're U.S. citizens. They're born in the U.S. Sorry. So she was coming back through Mexico without papers, trying to get back to the United States. And luckily in the shelter, they give them legal counsel, and they had talked her out of it. They said, go back. Once you try to go in illegally now, you're really in trouble. Go back. There's other legal work you can do from Honduras to regularize your status, to normalize your status. But stories like hers, I think, are really powerful, because what we think about as sort of illegal or undocumented is, you know, a blanket term that, you know, really obscures so many different kinds of situations. So hers was just one of them. In terms of our laws, you know, you say easing our laws and what would make a difference. Potentially, yeah, that, you know, legalizing marijuana or something like that would make a difference, potentially in terms of reducing demand. But clearly it has to be something much more powerful and much more holistic than that. The immigration policy of these two countries, the economic policies of these two countries, like I mentioned, CAFTA and NAFTA, the benefits have been very unequal, have dislocated many more people in these countries than they were supposed to benefit. So there needs to be a whole series of, I would call again, transnational kinds of discussions and reforms, rather than just the U.S. unilaterally doing things or Mexico unilaterally doing things. That might help a little bit, but still you can see how it's so entangled that one thing will certainly be a little bit of a release valve, but not a solution. Yeah.
Where do you see the leadership coming from? for the regional problem that involves more.
I don't. I don't see it. No, it's, you know, which is frustrating in this age of, you know, terrorism and war on drugs and all these other things, which are transnational. They're not like single country issues, and yet the way we operate in these things is still very much single country or these big multilateral, like the UN, you know, or NATO or things like that, that tend to be. Have their own sets of issues, but sort of we made it work with NAFTA, right? I mean, we were willing to sort of put our heads together and say, Canada, U.S., Mexico, what can we do economically to develop the region? But when we say drugs or migration, we're not willing to put our heads together the same way. So I don't see much leadership for that, unfortunately.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Reduced demand. We're the highest demand, yeah. But again, what you saw in those maps is, I mean, it's not just marijuana. It's methamphetamines. It's cocaine. There's a whole bunch of things. So it would take some edge off, but there's still, the problem goes a lot deeper. So we obviously aren't going to be...
There's no way to know what the impact is.
Yeah, yeah. That it would in some ways lower that demand because it's really in some ways it's making this so lucrative right now, right? More and more places in Mexico are growing marijuana. I mean, you know, we've seen for decades all these efforts in the Andes and other areas to get coca growers to stop growing coca, so to lower the amount of cocaine that's produced, and people around California, Mexico, everywhere, growing more and more marijuana, right? So certainly, you know, some of these things would help in some ways, I think, but the problem is a deeper and uglier one, which I apologize. This is the ugliness of an anthropological, you know, perspective in some ways, is that we're not reducing our vision to just sort of the economic part or the social part or the political part. Unfortunately, when you're on the ground, they all kind of come together. And so I was saying earlier to some of you about the messiness of it, which I think is really important to acknowledge, but also really difficult to engage as a policy issue. So, thank you for your great questions. Yeah.